moment later, I caught my breath, but I didn't say anything. I'd learned my lesson. Who were these clowns? They weren't wearing insignia. Maybe they were terrorists. I'd never really believed in terrorists before. I mean, I knew that in the abstract there were terrorists somewhere in the world, but they didn't really represent any risk to me. There were millions of ways that the world could kill me, starting with getting run down by a drunk burning his way down Valencia, that were infinitely more likely and immediate than terrorists. Terrorists killed a lot less people than bathroom falls and accidental electrocutions. Worrying about them always struck me as about as useful as worrying about getting hit by lightning. Sitting in the back of that Hummer, my head in a hood, my hands lashed behind my back, lurching back and forth while the bruises swelled up on my head, terrorism suddenly felt a lot riskier. The car rocked back and forth and tipped uphill. I gathered we were headed over Knob Hill, and from the angle, it seemed we were taking one of the steeper routes. I guessed Powell Street. Now we were descending just as steeply. If my mental map was right, we were heading down to Fisherman's Wharf. You could get on a boat there, get away. That fit with the terrorism hypothesis. Why the hell would terrorists kidnap a bunch of high school students? We rocked to a stop, still on a downslope. The engine died and then the doors swung open. Someone dragged me by my arms out onto the road, then shoved me, stumbling, down a paved road. A few seconds later, I tripped over a steel staircase, bashing my shins. The hands behind me gave me another shove. I went up the stairs cautiously, not able to use my hands. I got up the third step and reached for the fourth, but it wasn't there. I nearly fell again, but new hands grabbed me from in front and dragged me down a steel floor and then forced me to my knees and locked my hands to something behind me. More movement, and the sense of bodies being shackled in alongside of me. Groans and muffled sounds. Laughter. Then a long, timeless eternity in the muffled gloom, breathing my own breath, hearing my own breath in my ears. I actually managed a kind of sleep there, kneeling with the circulation cut off to my legs, my head in canvas twilight. My body had squirted a year's supply of adrenaline into my bloodstream in the space of 30 minutes. And while that stuff can give you the strength to lift cars off your loved ones and leap over tall buildings, the payback's always a bitch. I woke up to someone pulling the hood off my head. They were neither rough nor careful, just impersonal. Like someone at McDonald's putting together burgers. The light in the room was so bright I had to squeeze my eyes shut, but slowly I was able to open them to slits. Then cracks, then all the way, and look around. We were all in the back of a truck, a big 16-wheeler. I could see the wheel wells at regular intervals down the length, but the back of this truck had been turned into some kind of mobile command post jail. Steel desks lined the walls, with banks of slick flat panel displays climbing above them, on articulated arms that let them be repositioned in a halo around the operators. Each desk had a gorgeous office chair in front of it, festooned with user interface knobs for adjusting every millimeter of the sitting surface, as well as height, pitch, and yaw. Then there was the jail part. At the front of the truck, farthest away from the doors, there were steel rails bolted into the sides of the vehicle, and attached to these steel rails were the prisoners. I spotted Van and Holu right away. Daryl might have been in the remaining dozen shackled up back here, but it was impossible to say. Many of them were slumped over and blocking my view. It stank of sweat and fear back there. Vanessa looked at me and bit her lip. She was scared. So was I. So was Holu, his eyes rolling crazily in their sockets. The whites showing. I was scared. What's more, I had to piss like a racehorse. I looked around for our captors. I'd avoided looking at them up until now, the same way you don't look into the dark of a closet where your mind has conjured up a boogeyman. You don't want to know if you're right. But I had to get a better look at these jerks who'd kidnapped us. If they were terrorists, I wanted to know. I didn't know what a terrorist looked like, though TV shows had done their best to convince me that they were brown Arabs with big beards and knit caps and loose cotton dresses that hung down to their ankles. Not so our captors. They could have been halftime show cheerleaders on the Super Bowl. They looked American in a way I couldn't exactly define. Good jawlines, short, neat haircuts that weren't quite military. They came in white and brown, male and female, and smiled freely at one another as they sat down at the other end of the truck, joking and drinking coffee out of go cups. These weren't Arabs from Afghanistan. They looked like tourists from Nebraska. I stared at one, a young white woman with brown hair who barely looked older than me, kind of cute in a scary office power suit way. If you stare at someone long enough, they'll eventually look back at you. She did, and her face slammed into a totally different configuration, dispassionate, even robotic. The smile vanished in an instant. "Hey," I said. "Look, I don't understand what's going on here, but I really need to take a leak, you know?" She looked right through me as if she hadn't heard. "I'm serious. If I don't get to a can soon, I'm going to have an ugly accident. It's going to get pretty smelly back here, you know?" She turned to her colleagues, a little huddle of three of them, and they held a low conversation I couldn't hear over the fans from the computers. She turned back to me. "Hold it for another 10 minutes, then you'll each get a piss call." "I don't think I've got another 10 minutes in me," I said, letting a little more urgency than I was really feeling creep into my voice. "Seriously, lady, it's now or never." She shook her head and looked at me like I was some kind of pathetic loser. She and her friends conferred some more, then another one came forward. He was older, in his early 30s, and pretty big across the shoulders, like he worked out. He looked like he was Chinese or Korean. Even Van can't tell the difference sometimes, but with that bearing that said American in a way I couldn't put my finger on. He pulled his sports coat aside to let me see the hardware strapped there. I recognized a pistol, a taser, and a can of either mace or pepper spray before he let it fall again.
"No trouble," he said.
"None," I agreed. He touched something at his belt, and the shackles behind me let go, my arms dropping suddenly behind me. It was like he was wearing Batman's utility belt. Wireless remotes for shackles. I guessed it made sense, though. You wouldn't want to lean over your prisoners with all that deadly hardware at their eye level. They might grab your gun with their teeth and pull the trigger with their tongues or something. My hands were still lashed together behind me by the plastic strapping, and now that I wasn't supported by the shackles, I found that my legs had turned into lumps of cork while I was stuck in one position. Long story short, I basically fell onto my face and kicked my legs weakly as they went pins and needles, trying to get them under me so I could rock up to my feet. The guy jerked me to my feet, and I clown-walked to the very back of the truck, to a little boxed-in port-a-john there. I tried to spot Daryl on the way back, but he could have been any of the 5 or 6 slumped people, or none of them.
"In you go," the guy said.
I jerked my wrists. "Take these off, please." My fingers felt like purple sausages from the hours of bondage in the plastic cuffs. The guy didn't move. "Look," I said, trying not to sound sarcastic or angry. It wasn't easy. "Look, you either cut my wrists free or you're going to have to aim for me. A toilet visit is not a hands-free experience." Someone in the truck sniggered. The guy didn't like me. I could tell from the way his jaw muscles ground around. Man, these people were wired tight. He reached down to his belt and came up with a very nice set of multipliers. He flicked out a wicked-looking knife and sliced through the plastic cuffs, and my hands were my own again.
Thanks, I said. He shoved me into the bathroom. My hands were useless, like lumps of clay on the ends of my wrists. As I wiggled my fingers limply, they tingled. Then the tingling turned to a burning feeling that almost made me cry out. I put the seat down, dropped my pants, and sat down. I didn't trust myself to stay on my feet. As my bladder cut loose, so did my eyes. I wept, crying silently and rocking back and forth while the tears and snot ran down my face. It was all I could do to keep from sobbing. I covered my mouth and held the sounds in. I didn't want to give them the satisfaction. Finally, I was peed out and cried out, and the guy was pounding on the door. I cleaned my face as best as I could with wads of toilet paper, stuck it all down the john and flushed, then looked around for a sink but only found a pump bottle of heavy-duty hand sanitizer covered in small print lists of the bioagents it worked on. I rubbed some into my hands and stepped out of the john.
What were you doing in there? The guy said.
Using the facilities, I said. He turned me around and grabbed my hands, and I felt a new pair of plastic cuffs go around them. My wrists had swollen since the last pair had come off, and the new ones bit cruelly into my tender skin, but I refused to give him the satisfaction of crying out. He shackled me back to my spot and grabbed the next person down, who, I saw now, was Holu, his face puffy and an ugly bruise on his cheek. "Are you okay?" I asked him, and my friend with the utility belt abruptly put his hand on my forehead and shoved hard, bouncing the back of my head off the truck's metal wall with a sound like a clock striking one.
"No talking," he said as I struggled to refocus my eyes. I didn't like these people. I decided right then that they would pay a price for all this.
One by one, all the prisoners went to the can and came back, and when they were done, my guard went back to his friends and had another cup of coffee. They were drinking out of a big cardboard urn of Starbucks, I saw, and they had an indistinct conversation that involved a fair bit of laughter. Then the door at the back of the truck opened, and there was fresh air. Not smoky the way it had been before, but tinged with ozone. In the slice of outdoors I saw before the door closed, I caught that it was dark out and raining, with one of those San Francisco drizzles that's part mist. The man who came in was wearing a military uniform, a U.S. military uniform. He saluted the people in the truck and they saluted him back, and that's when I knew that I wasn't a prisoner of some terrorists. I was a prisoner of the United States of America. They set up a little screen at the end of the truck and then came for us one at a time, unshackling us and leading us to the back of the truck. As close as I could work it, counting seconds off in my head, one hippopotami, two hippopotami, the interviews lasted about 7 minutes each. My head throbbed with dehydration and caffeine withdrawal. I was third, brought back by the woman with the severe haircut. Up close, she looked tired, with bags under her eyes and grim lines at the corners of her mouth. "Thanks," I said automatically, as she unlocked me with the remote and then dragged me to my feet. I hated myself for the automatic politeness, but it had been drilled into me. She didn't twitch a muscle. I went ahead of her to the back of the truck and behind the screen. There was a single folding chair, and I sat in it. Two of them, severe haircut lady and utility belt man, looked at me from their ergonomic super chairs. They had a little table between them with the contents of my wallet and backpack spread out on it. "Hello, Marcus," severe haircut lady said. "We have some questions for you." "Am I under arrest?" I asked. This wasn't an idle question. If you're not under arrest, there are limits on what the cops can and can't do to you. For starters, they can't hold you forever without arresting you, giving you a phone call, and letting you talk to a lawyer. And who, boy, was I ever going to talk to a lawyer? "What's this for?" she said, holding up my phone. The screen was showing the error message you got if you kept trying to get into its data without giving the right password. It was a bit of a rude message, an animated hand giving a certain universally recognized gesture, because I liked to customize my gear. "Am I under arrest?" I repeated. "They can't make you answer any questions if you're not under arrest, and when you ask if you're under arrest, they have to answer you. It's the rules." "You're being detained by the Department of Homeland Security," the woman snapped. "Am I under arrest?" "You're going to be more cooperative, Marcus, starting right now." She didn't say, "or else," but it was implied. "I would like to contact an attorney," I said. "I would like to know what I've been charged with. I would like to see some form of identification from both of you." The two agents exchanged looks. "I think you should really reconsider your approach to the situation," severe haircut lady said. "I think you should do that right now. We found a number of suspicious devices on your person. We found you and your confederates near the site of the worst terrorist attack this country has ever seen. Put those two facts together, and things don't look very good for you, Marcus. You can cooperate, or you can be very, very sorry. Now, what is this for? You think I'm a terrorist? I'm 17 years old! Just the right age. Al-Qaeda loves recruiting impressionable, idealistic kids. We Googled you, you know. You've posted a lot of very ugly stuff on the public internet." "I would like to speak to an attorney," I said. Severe haircut lady looked at me like I was a bug. "You're under the mistaken impression that you've been picked up by the police for a crime. You need to get past that. You are being detained as a potential enemy combatant by the government of the United States. If I were you, I'd be thinking very hard about how to convince us that you are not an enemy combatant. Very hard. Because there are dark holes that enemy combatants can disappear into. Very dark, deep holes. Holes where you can just vanish. Forever. Are you listening to me, young man? I want you to unlock this phone and then decrypt the files in its memory. I want you to account for yourself. Why were you out on the street? What do you know about the attack on this city?"
"I'm not going to unlock my phone for you," I said, indignant. "My phone's memory had all kinds of private stuff on it. Photos, emails, little hacks and mods I'd installed. That's private stuff."
"What have you got to hide?"
"I've got the right to my privacy," I said. "And I want to speak to an attorney."
"This is your last chance, kid. Honest people don't have anything to hide."
"I want to speak to an attorney." My parents would pay for it. All the FAQs on getting arrested were clear on this point. Just keep asking to see an attorney, no matter what they say or do. There's no good that comes of talking to the cops without your lawyer present. These two said they weren't cops, but if this wasn't an arrest, what was it? In hindsight, maybe I should have unlocked my phone for them.
Chapter 4. They reshackled and rehooded me and left me there. A long time later, the truck started to move, rolling downhill, and then I was hauled back to my feet. I immediately fell over. My legs were so asleep they felt like blocks of ice, all except my knees, which were swollen and tender from all the hours of kneeling. Hands grabbed my shoulders and feet, and I was picked up like a sack of potatoes. There were indistinct voices around me, someone crying, someone cursing. I was carried a short distance, then set down and reshackled to another railing. My knees wouldn't support me anymore, and I pitched forward, ending up twisted on the ground like a pretzel, straining against the chains holding my wrists. Then we were moving again. And this time, it wasn't like driving in a truck. The floor beneath me rocked gently and vibrated with heavy diesel engines, and I realized I was on a ship. My stomach turned to ice. I was being taken off America's shores to somewhere else, and who the hell knew where that was? I'd been scared before, but this thought terrified me, left me paralyzed and wordless with fear. I realized that I might never see my parents again, and I actually tasted a little vomit burn up my throat. The bag over my head closed in on me, and I could barely breathe, something that was compounded by the weird position I was twisted into. But, mercifully, we weren't on the water for very long. It felt like an hour, but I know now that it was a mere 15 minutes, and then I felt us docking, felt footsteps on the decking around me, and felt other prisoners being unshackled and carried or led away. When they came for me, I tried to stand again, but couldn't, and they carried me again, impersonally, roughly. When they took the hood off again, I was in a cell. The cell was old and crumbled and smelled of sea air. There was one window high up and rusted bars guarded it. It was still dark outside. There was a blanket on the floor and a little metal toilet without a seat set into the wall. The guard who took off my hood grinned at me and closed the solid steel door behind him. I gently massaged my legs, hissing as the blood came back into them and into my hands. Eventually, I was able to stand, and then to pace. I heard other people talking, crying, shouting. I did some shouting, too. Kolu! Daryl! Vanessa! Other voices on the cell block took up the cry, shouting out names, too, shouting out obscenities. The nearest voices sounded like drunks losing their minds on a street corner. Maybe I sounded like that, too. Guards shouted at us to be quiet, and that just made everyone yell louder. Eventually, we were all howling, screaming our heads off, screaming our throats raw. Why not? What did we have to lose? The next time they came to question me, I was filthy and tired, thirsty and hungry. Severe haircut lady was in the new questioning party, as were three big guys who moved me around like a cut of meat. One was black, the other two were white, though one might have been Hispanic. They all carried guns. It was like a Benetton's ad crossed with a game of Counter-Strike. They'd taken me from my cell and chained my wrists and ankles together. I paid attention to my surroundings as we went. I heard water outside and thought that maybe we were on Alcatraz. It was a prison, after all. Even if it had been a tourist attraction for generations, the place where you went to see where Al Capone and his gangster contemporaries did their time. But I'd been to Alcatraz on a school trip. It was old and rusted, medieval. This place felt like it dated back to World War II, not colonial times. There were barcodes, laser printed on stickers and placed on each of the cell doors, and numbers. But other than that, there was no way to tell who or what might be behind them. The interrogation room was modern, with fluorescent lights, ergonomic chairs, not for me, though. I got a folding plastic garden chair, and a big wooden boardroom table. A mirror lined one wall, just like in the cop shows, and I figured someone or other must be watching from behind it. Severe haircut lady and her friends helped themselves to coffee from an urn on a side table. I could have torn her throat out with my teeth and taken her coffee just then. And then set a styrofoam cup of water down next to me, without unlocking my wrists from behind my back, so I couldn't reach it. Hardy har har. "Hello, Marcus," severe haircut lady said. "How's your two doing today?" I didn't say anything. "This isn't as bad as it gets, you know," she said. "This is as good as it gets from now on. Even once you tell us what we want to know, even if that convinces us that you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, you're a marked man now. We'll be watching you everywhere you go and everything you do. You've acted like you've got something to hide, and we don't like that." It's pathetic, but all my brain could think about was that phrase, "convince us that you are in the wrong place at the wrong time." This was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. I had never, ever felt this bad or this scared before. Those words, "wrong place at the wrong time," those six words, they were like a lifeline dangling before me as I thrashed to stay on the surface.
Hello, Marcus. She snapped her fingers in front of my face. Over here, Marcus.
There was a little smile on her face, and I hated myself for letting her see my fear.
Marcus, it can be a lot worse than this. This isn't the worst place we can put you, not by a damn sight.
She reached down below the table and came out with a briefcase, which she snapped open. From it, she withdrew my phone, my ARFID sniper cloner, my Wi-Finder, and my memory keys. She set them down on the table, one after the other.
Here's what we want from you. You unlock the phone for us today. If you do that, you'll get outdoor and bathing privileges. You'll get a shower, and you'll be allowed to walk around in the exercise yard. Tomorrow we'll bring you back and ask you to decrypt the data on these memory sticks. Do that, and you'll get to eat in the mess hall. The day after, we're going to want your email passwords, and that will get you library privileges.
The word no was on my lips, like a burp trying to come up, but it wouldn't come. Why? Is what came out instead.
We want to be sure that you're what you seem to be. This is about your security, Marcus. Say you're innocent. You might be, though why an innocent man would act like he's got so much to hide is beyond me. But say you are. You could have been on that bridge when it blew. Your parents could have been. Your friends. Don't you want us to catch the people who attacked your home?
It's funny, but when she was talking about my getting privileges, it scared me into submission. I felt like I'd done something to end up where I was, like maybe it was partially my fault, like I could do something to change it. But as soon as she switched to this BS about safety and security, my spine came back.
Lady, I said, you're talking about attacking my home, but as far as I can tell, you're the only one who's attacked me lately. I thought I lived in a country with a constitution. I thought I lived in a country where I had rights. You're talking about defending my freedom by tearing up the Bill of Rights.
A flicker of annoyance passed over her face, then went away.
So melodramatic, Marcus. No one's attacked you. You've been detained by your country's government while we seek details on the worst terrorist attack ever perpetrated on our nation's soil. You have it within your power to help us fight this war on our nation's enemies. You want to preserve the Bill of Rights? Help us stop bad people from blowing up your city. Now, you have exactly 30 seconds to unlock that phone before I send you back to your cell. We have lots of other people to interview today.
She looked at her watch. I rattled my wrists. Rattled the chains that kept me from reaching around and unlocking the phone. Yes, I was going to do it. She'd told me what my path was to freedom, to the world, to my parents, and that had given me hope. Now she'd threatened to send me away, to take me off that path, and my hope had crashed, and all I could think of was how to get back on it. So I rattled my wrists, wanting to get to my phone and unlock it for her, and she just looked at me coldly, checking her watch. The password, I said, finally understanding what she wanted of me. She wanted me to say it out loud, here, where she could record it, where her pals could hear it. She didn't want me to just unlock the phone. She wanted me to submit to her, to put her in charge of me, to give up every secret, all my privacy. The password, I said again, and then I told her the password. God help me. I submitted to her will. She smiled a little prim smile, which had to be her Ice Queen equivalent of a touchdown dance, and the guards led me away. As the door closed, I saw her bend down over the phone and key the password in. I wish I could say that I'd anticipated this possibility in advance and created a fake password that unlocked a completely innocuous partition on my phone, but I wasn't nearly that paranoid clever. You might be wondering at this point what dark secrets I had locked away on my phone and memory sticks and email. I'm just a kid, after all. The truth is, I had everything to hide, and nothing. Between my phone and my memory sticks, you could get a pretty good idea of who my friends were, what I thought of them, all the goofy things we'd done. You could read the transcripts of the electronic arguments we'd carried out and the electronic reconciliations we'd arrived at. You see, I don't delete stuff. Why would I? Storage is cheap, and you never know when you're going to want to go back to that stuff, especially the stupid stuff. You know that feeling you get sometimes where you're sitting on the subway and there's no one to talk to and you suddenly remember some bitter fight you had, some terrible thing you said? Well, it's usually never as bad as you remember. Being able to go back and see it again is a great way to remind yourself that you're not as horrible a person as you think you are. Daryl and I have gotten over more fights that way than I can count. And even that's not it. I know my phone is private. I know my memory sticks are private. That's because of cryptography, message scrambling. The math behind crypto is good and solid, and you and me get access to the same crypto that banks and the National Security Agency use. There's only one kind of crypto that anyone uses, crypto that's public, open, and can be deployed by anyone. That's how you know it works. There's something really liberating about having some corner of your life that's yours, that no one gets to see except you. It's a little like nudity or taking a dump. Everyone gets naked every once in a while. Everyone has to squat on the toilet. There's nothing shameful, deviant, or weird about either of them. But what if I decreed that from now on, every time you went to evacuate some solid waste, you'd have to do it in a glass room perched in the middle of Times Square, and you'd be buck naked. Even if you've got nothing wrong or weird with your body, and how many of us can say that, you'd have to be pretty strange to like that idea. Most of us would run screaming. Most of us would hold it in until we exploded. It's not about doing something shameful. It's about doing something private. It's about your life. Belonging to you. They were taking that from me, piece by piece. As I walked back to my cell, that feeling of deserving it came back to me. I'd broken a lot of rules all my life, and I'd gotten away with it, by and large. Maybe this was justice. Maybe this was my past coming back to me. After all, I had been where I was because I'd snuck out of school. I got my shower. I got to walk around the yard. There was a patch of sky overhead, and it smelled like the Bay Area. But beyond that, I had no clue where I was being held. No other prisoners were visible during my exercise period, and I got pretty bored with walking in circles. I strained my ears for any sound that might help me understand what this place was, but all I heard was the occasional vehicle. Some distant conversations, a plane landing somewhere nearby. They brought me back to my cell and fed me. A half a pepperoni pie from Goat Hill Pizza, which I knew well, up on Potrero Hill. The carton with its familiar graphic and 415 phone number was a reminder that only a day before I'd been a free man in a free country and that now I was a prisoner. I worried constantly about Daryl and fretted about my other friends. Maybe they'd been more cooperative and had been released. Maybe they'd told my parents and they were frantically calling around. Maybe not. The cell was fantastically spare, empty as my soul. I fantasized that the wall opposite my bunk was a screen that I could be hacking right now, opening the cell door. I fantasized about my workbench and the projects there. The old cans I was turning into a ghetto surround sound rig. The aerial photography kite cam I was building. My homebrew laptop. I wanted to get out of there. I wanted to go home and have my friends and my school and my parents and my life back. I wanted to be able to go where I wanted to go. Not be stuck pacing. And pacing, and pacing. They took my passwords for my USB keys next. Those held some interesting messages I'd downloaded from one online discussion group or another, some chat transcripts, things where people had helped me out with some of the knowledge I needed to do the things I did. There was nothing on there you couldn't find with Google, of course, but I didn't think that would count in my favor. I got exercise again that afternoon, and this time there were others in the yard when I got there, 4 other guys and 2 women, of all ages and racial backgrounds. I guess lots of people were doing things to earn their privileges. They gave me 30 minutes, and I tried to make conversation with the most normal-seeming of the other prisoners, a black guy about my age with a short afro. But when I introduced myself and stuck my hand out, he cut his eyes toward the cameras mounted ominously in the corners of the yard and kept walking without ever changing his facial expression. But then, just before they called my name and brought me back into the building, the door opened, and out came Vanessa. I'd never been more glad to see a friendly face. She looked tired and grumpy, but not hurt, and when she saw me, she shouted my name and ran to me. We hugged each other hard, and I realized I was shaking. Then I realized she was shaking, too. "Are you okay?" she said, holding me at arm's length. "I'm okay," I said. They told me they'd let me go if I gave them my passwords. "They keep asking me questions about you and Daryl." There was a voice blaring over the loudspeaker, shouting at us to stop talking, to walk. But we ignored it. "Answer them," I said instantly. "Anything they ask, answer them, if it'll get you out. How are Daryl and Holu?" "I haven't seen them." The door banged open and 4 big guards boiled out. 2 took me and 2 took Vanessa. They forced me to the ground and turned my head away from Vanessa, though I heard her getting the same treatment. Plastic cuffs went around my wrists, and then I was yanked to my feet and brought back to my cell. No dinner came that night. No breakfast came the next morning. No one came and brought me to the interrogation room to extract more of my secrets. The plastic cuffs didn't come off, and my shoulders burned, then ached, then went numb, then burned again. I lost all feeling in my hands. I had to pee. I couldn't undo my pants. I really, really had to pee. I pissed myself. They came for me after that. Once the hot piss had cooled and gone clammy, making my already filthy jeans stick to my legs. They came for me and walked me down the long hall lined with doors, each door with its own barcode, each barcode a prisoner like me. They walked me down the corridor and brought me to the interrogation room, and it was like a different planet when I entered there. A world where things were normal, where everything didn't reek of urine. I felt so dirty and ashamed, and all those feelings of deserving what I got came back to me. Severe haircut lady was already sitting. She was perfect, coiffed and with just a little makeup. I smelled her hair stuff. She wrinkled her nose at me. I felt the shame rise in me. "Well, you've been a very naughty boy, haven't you? Aren't you a filthy thing?" Shame. I looked down at the table. I couldn't bear to look up. I wanted to tell her my email password and get gone. "What did you and your friend talk about in the yard?" I barked a laugh at the table. "I told her to answer your questions. I told her to cooperate." "So, do you give the orders?" I felt the blood sing in my ears. "Oh, come on," I said. "We play a game together. It's called Harajuku Fun Madness. I'm the team captain. We're not terrorists. We're high school students. I don't give her orders. I told her that we needed to be honest with you so that we could clear up any suspicion and get out of here." She didn't say anything for a moment. "How is Daryl?" I said.
"Who?"
"Daryl. You picked us up together, my friend. Someone had stabbed him in the Powell Street BART. That's why we were up on the surface, to get him help."
"I'm sure he's fine then," she said.
My stomach knotted, and I almost threw up.
You don't know? You haven't got him here?
Who we have here and who we don't have here is not something we're going to discuss with you. Ever. That's not something you're going to know. Marcus, you've seen what happens when you don't cooperate with us. You've seen what happens when you disobey our orders. You've been a little cooperative, and it's gotten you almost to the point where you might go free again. If you want to make that possibility into a reality, you'll stick to answering my questions.
I didn't say anything.
You're learning. That's good. Now, your email passwords, please.
I was ready for this. I gave them everything. Server address, login, password. This didn't matter. I didn't keep any email on my server. I downloaded it all and kept it on my laptop at home, which downloaded and deleted my mail from the server every 60 seconds. They wouldn't get anything out of my mail. It got cleared off the server and stored on my laptop at home. Back to the cell. But they cut loose my hands and they gave me a shower and a pair of orange prison pants to wear. They were too big for me and hung down low on my hips, like a Mexican gang kid in the mission. That's where the baggy pants down your ass look comes from, you know that? From prison. I tell you what, it's less fun when it's not a fashion statement. They took away my jeans, and I spent another day in the cell. The walls were scratched cement over a steel grid. You could tell because the steel was rusting in the salt air, and the grid shone through the green paint in red-orange. My parents were out that window, somewhere. They came for me again the next day.
We've been reading your mail for a day now. We changed the password so that your home computer couldn't fetch it.
Well, of course they had. I would have done the same, now that I thought of it.
We have enough on you now to put you away for a very long time, Marcus. Your possession of these articles, she gestured at all my little gizmos, and the data we recovered from your phone and memory sticks, as well as the subversive material we'd no doubt find if we raided your house and took your computer. It's enough to put you away until you're an old man. Do you understand that?
I didn't believe it for a second. There's no way a judge would say that all this stuff constituted any kind of real crime. It was free speech. It was technological tinkering. It wasn't a crime. But who said that these people would ever put me in front of a judge?
We know where you live. We know who your friends are. We know how you operate and how you think.
It dawned on me then. They were about to let me go. The room seemed to brighten. I heard myself breathing, short little breaths.
We just want to know one thing. What was the delivery mechanism for the bombs on the bridge?
I stopped breathing. The room darkened again.
What?
There were 10 charges on the bridge all along its length. They weren't in car trunks. They'd been placed there. Who placed them there and how did they get there?
What?
I said it again.
This is your last chance, Marcus, she said.
She looked sad.
You were doing so well until now. Tell us this and you can go home. You can get a lawyer and defend yourself in a court of law. There are doubtless extenuating circumstances that you can use to explain your actions. Just tell us this thing and you're gone.
I don't know what you're talking about. I was crying and I didn't even care. Sobbing, blubbering.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
She shook her head.
Marcus, please. Let us help you. By now you know that we always get what we're after.
There was a gibbering sound in the back of my mind. They were insane. I pulled myself together, working hard to stop the tears.
Listen, lady, this is nuts. You've been into my stuff, you've seen it all. I'm a 17-year-old high school student, not a terrorist. You can't seriously think...
Marcus, haven't you figured out that we're serious yet? She shook her head.
You get pretty good grades. I thought you'd be smarter than that. She made a flicking gesture, and the guards picked me up by the armpits. Back in my cell, 100 little speeches occurred to me. The French call this esprit d'escalier, the spirit of the staircase, the snappy rebuttals that come to you after you leave the room and slink down the stairs. In my mind, I stood and delivered, telling her that I was a citizen who loved my freedom, which made me the patriot and made her the traitor. In my mind, I shamed her for turning my country into an armed camp. In my mind, I was eloquent and brilliant and reduced her to tears. But you know what? None of those fine words came back to me when they pulled me out the next day. All I could think of was freedom. My parents.
"Hello, Marcus," she said. "How are you feeling?"
I looked down at the table. She had a neat pile of documents in front of her and her ubiquitous go cup of Starbucks beside her. I found it comforting somehow, a reminder that there was a real world out there somewhere, beyond the walls.
"We're through investigating you, for now."
She let that hang there. Maybe it meant that she was letting me go. Maybe it meant that she was going to throw me in a pit and forget that I existed. "And," I said finally,
"and I want to impress on you again that we are very serious about this. Our country has experienced the worst attack ever committed on its soil. How many 9/11s do you want us to suffer before you're willing to cooperate? The details of our investigation are secret. We won't stop at anything in our efforts to bring the perpetrators of these heinous crimes to justice. Do you understand that?"
"Yes," I mumbled.
"We're going to send you home today, but you are a marked man. You have not been found to be above suspicion. We're only releasing you because we're done questioning you for now. But from now on, you belong to us. We will be watching you. We will be waiting for you to make a misstep. Do you understand that we can watch you closely, all the time?"
"Yes," I mumbled.
"Good. You'll never speak of what happened here to anyone, ever. This is a matter of national security. Do you know that the death penalty still holds for treason in time of war?"
"Yes," I mumbled.
"Good boy," she purred. "We have some papers here for you to sign."
She pushed the stack of papers across the table to me.
Little post-its with "Sign Here" printed on them had been stuck throughout them.
A guard undid my cuffs. I paged through the papers and my eyes watered and my head swam. I couldn't make sense of them. I tried to decipher the legalese. It seemed that I was signing a declaration that I had been voluntarily held and submitted to voluntary questioning of my own free will.
"What happens if I don't sign this?" I said. She snatched the papers back and made that flicking gesture again. The guards jerked me to my feet.
"Wait!" I cried. "Please, I'll sign them."
They dragged me to the door. All I could see was that door. All I could think of was it closing behind me. I lost it. I wept. I begged to be allowed to sign the papers. To be so close to freedom and have it snatched away, it made me ready to do anything. I can't count the number of times I've heard someone say, "Oh, I'd rather die than do something or other." I've said it myself now and again. But that was the first time I understood what it really meant. I would have rather died than go back to my cell. I begged as they took me out into the corridor. I told them I'd sign anything. She called out to the guards and they stopped. They brought me back. They sat me down. One of them put the pen in my hand. Of course, I signed and signed and signed. My jeans and t-shirt were back in my cell, laundered and folded. They smelled of detergent. I put them on and washed my face and sat on my cot and stared at the wall. They'd taken everything from me. First my privacy, then my dignity. I'd been ready to sign anything. I would have signed a confession that said I'd assassinated Abraham Lincoln.
I tried to cry, but it was like my eyes were dry, out of tears. They got me again. A guard approached me with a hood, like the hood I'd been put in when they picked us up, whenever that was, days ago, weeks ago. The hood went over my head and cinched tight at my neck. I was in total darkness, and the air was stifling and stale. I was raised to my feet and walked down corridors, upstairs, on gravel, up a gangplank, on a ship's steel deck. My hands were chained behind me to a railing. I knelt on the deck and listened to the thrum of the diesel engines. The ship moved. A hint of salt air made its way into the hood. It was drizzling, and my clothes were heavy with water. I was outside, even if my head was in a bag. I was outside, in the world, moments from my freedom. They came for me and led me off the boat and over uneven ground, up 3 metal stairs. My wrists were unshackled. My hood was removed. I was back in the truck. Severe haircut woman was there, at the little desk she'd sat at before. She had a Ziploc bag with her, and inside it were my phone and other little devices, my wallet and the change from my pockets. She handed them to me wordlessly. I filled my pockets. It felt so weird to have everything back in its familiar place, to be wearing my familiar clothes. Outside the truck's back door, I heard the familiar sounds of my familiar city. A guard passed me my backpack. The woman extended her hand to me. I just looked at it. She put it down and gave me a wry smile. Then she mimed, zipping up her lips and pointed to me and opened the door. It was daylight outside, gray and drizzling. I was looking down an alley toward cars and trucks and bikes zipping down the road. I stood transfixed on the truck's top step, staring at freedom. My knees shook. I knew now that they were playing with me again. In a moment, the guards would grab me and drag me back inside. The bag would go over my head again, and I would be back on the boat and sent off to the prison again, to the endless, unanswerable questions. I barely held myself back from stuffing my fist in my mouth. Then I forced myself to go down one stair, another stair, the last stair. My sneakers crunched down on the crap on the alley's floor. Broken glass, a needle, gravel. I took a step. Another. I reached the mouth of the alley and stepped onto the sidewalk. No one grabbed me. I was free. Then strong arms threw themselves around me. I nearly cried. Chapter 5. But it was Van, and she was crying, and hugging me so hard I couldn't breathe. I didn't care. I hugged her back, my face buried in her hair. "You're okay," she said. "I'm okay," I managed. She finally let go of me, and another set of arms wrapped themselves around me. It was Holu. They were both there. He whispered, "You're safe, bro," in my ear and hugged me even tighter than Vanessa had. When he let go, I looked around. "Where's Daryl?" I asked. They both looked at each other. "Maybe he's still in the truck," Holu said. We turned and looked at the truck at the alley's end. It was a nondescript white 18-wheeler. Someone had already brought the little folding staircase inside. The rear lights glowed red, and the truck rolled backwards toward us, emitting a steady eep, eep, eep. "Wait!" I shouted as it accelerated toward us. "Wait! What about Daryl?" The truck drew closer. I kept shouting, "What about Daryl?" Holu and Vanessa each had me by an arm and were dragging me away. I struggled against them, shouting. The truck pulled out of the alley's mouth and reversed into the street and pointed itself downhill and drove away. I tried to run after it, but Van and Holu wouldn't let me go. I sat down on the sidewalk and put my arms around my knees and cried. I cried and cried and cried, loud sobs of the sort I hadn't done since I was a little kid. They wouldn't stop coming. I couldn't stop shaking. Vanessa and Holu got me to my feet and moved me a little ways up the street. There was a Muni bus stop with a bench, and they sat me on it. They were both crying, too, and we held each other for a while. And I knew we were crying for Daryl, whom none of us ever expected to see again. We were north of Chinatown, at the part where it starts to become North Beach, a neighborhood with a bunch of neon strip clubs and the legendary City Lights Counterculture bookstore, where the beat poetry movement had been founded back in the 1950s. I knew this part of town well. My parents' favorite Italian restaurant was here, and they liked to take me here for big plates of linguine and huge Italian ice cream mountains with candied figs and lethal little espressos afterward. Now it was a different place. A place where I was tasting freedom for the first time in what seemed like an eternity. We checked our pockets and found enough money to get a table at one of the Italian restaurants, out on the sidewalk, under an awning. The pretty waitress lighted a gas heater with a barbecue lighter, took our orders, and went inside. The sensation of giving orders, of controlling my destiny, was the most amazing thing I'd ever felt. "How long were we in there?" I asked.
6 days, Vanessa said.
I got 5, Holu said. I didn't count.
What did they do to you? Vanessa said.
I didn't want to talk about it, but they were both looking at me. Once I started, I couldn't stop. I told them everything, even when I'd been forced to piss myself, and they took it all in silently. I paused when the waitress delivered our sodas and waited until she got out of earshot, then finished. In the telling, it receded into the distance. By the end of it, I couldn't tell if I was embroidering the truth or if I was making it all seem less bad. My memories swam like little fish that I snatched at, and sometimes they wriggled out of my grasp. Halu shook his head.
"They were hard on you, dude," he said.
He told us about his stay there. They'd questioned him, mostly about me, and he'd kept on telling them the truth, sticking to a plain telling of the facts about that day and about our friendship. They had gotten him to repeat it over and over again, but they hadn't played games with his head the way they had with me. He'd eaten his meals in a mess hall with a bunch of other people, and been given time in a TV room where they were shown last year's blockbusters on video. Vanessa's story was only slightly different. After she'd gotten them angry by talking to me, they'd taken away her clothes and made her wear a set of orange prison coveralls. She'd been left in her cell for 2 days without contact, though she'd been fed regularly. But mostly it was the same as Holu, the same questions, repeated again and again.
"They really hated you," Holu said. "Really had it in for you. Why?"
I couldn't imagine why. Then I remembered. You can cooperate, or you can be very, very sorry. It was because I wouldn't unlock my phone for them that first night. That's why they singled me out. I couldn't believe it, but there was no other explanation. It had been sheer vindictiveness. My mind reeled at the thought. They had done all that as a mere punishment for defying their authority. I had been scared. Now I was angry.
"Those bastards," I said softly. "They did it to get back at me for mouthing off."
Holu swore, and then Vanessa cut loose in Korean, something she only did when she was really, really angry.
"I'm going to get them," I whispered, staring at my soda. "I'm going to get them."
Holu shook his head. "You can't, you know. You can't fight back against that." None of us much wanted to talk about revenge then. Instead, we talked about what we would do next. We had to go home. Our phone's batteries were dead, and it had been years since this neighborhood had any payphones. We just needed to go home. I even thought about taking a taxi, but there wasn't enough money between us to make